This is Embodied on the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Many of the public health recommendations during the pandemic have focused on keeping your bubble to the folks in your household. Yet close to a third of adults in the U.S. live alone. This gap between policy and lived reality is all too common when it comes to definitions of family. I know that as I tried to figure out who's in my bubble and who's out, it wasn't just biology and legal documents that were the deciding factor. It was about balancing my safety and sanity and being honest with myself about what kind of support I get from various people in my life. These decisions are nothing new for a lot of people. The closed definition of a two-parent nuclear family was always an exclusive concept. Non-traditional families have been championed by LGBTQ communities and Black and Brown folks for generations. Today on Embodied, we'll hear from about some of the lessons and difficulties of choosing family. Eliar Posada is with me. He's a Community Engagement and Advocacy Department Director at El Centro Hispano. Hey, Eliar, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course. I'd love to start hearing a bit about your experience being introduced to your chosen family. How did they come into your life?
Yeah, so for folks at home, so I'm Latino. My family is fairly conservative, right? So when I came out, it wasn't the best experience. All right, so I had to find that support that I didn't have at home with you know, folks who were part of my life, right? Before even I came out to my family, so. I came into the programs at El Centro as a college student because I heard about them. You know, I was going to a predominantly white institution, you know, very few Latinos out there. So I was like, I need to find my people.
Oh, I'm sorry, Eliasar, are you still with us?
And after I came out, they became my family because that's where I went to support. That's who I can talk to about anything, whether it be relationships or stresses going on or ask for advice. And as I got more involved in the Latinx LGBTQ community, my chosen family grew, right? So I have kind of like a mother figure now in the picture.
Well, yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, because it's interesting that, you know, as you mentioned kind of growing up and having some distance from your biological family and seeking out support in these support networks through El Centro Hispano. And through that, you were kind of able to replicate some of the norms of a traditional family household in the way that your chosen family looks. So talk about that. Talk about this mother figure and how the development of those various roles came to be for you.
Yeah, so it started because after I graduated, I took on the coordinator position of the support group, right? And then the coordinator for the trans group, Cristina, we became close friends. And then she became this kind of like mothering figure in my life, right, for some time after I had to move to Durham. I lived in her apartment, right? So I still remember her going into my room and tidying it up. And I'm like, what are you doing? and now it's one of those scenarios where she knows basically everything going on in my life. She calls me to check up on me. This Monday, the day before the election, based on my work, I had to do a lot of interviews and I was going to talk to one of my heroes on Tuesday. And she calls me up and she's like, you need to get your hair cut. You look horrible. What are you doing? Right? So I was like, what? There I go at 8 p.m. at night to her house so that she could cut my hair so that I could look decent the next day, right? And that's she's become that person, right? When I was going through relationship issues, she was there. She's always up in, I want to say she's always up in my business, but I love it, right? Because she's keeping an eye on me. And that's kind of like the relationships that are formed in my community, right? Because a lot of folks, you know, I thankfully have the privilege to have been able to rebuild some of that relationship with my mother, right? But a lot of folks in our community don't have that privilege. So they rely on people like Cristina to take on that parenting figure, everything from providing support to providing guidance, right? Because she is not shy at all to, like, have a come-to-Jesus meeting with me and let me know when I'm messing up.
I want to bring in one more guest to the program now. Chaos is a Durham-based multidisciplinary artist. Hey, Chaos, welcome to the show. Are you there? Okay, we'll take a second and reconnect with Chaos. Eliasar, I mean, what you say about that is so interesting because it's kind of a push-pull in is what I hear when I hear you talking about. There are some things that kind of pushed you away from your biological family, them, you know, excluding you or not accepting you. And then this pull of this need to, the need to belong, the need to have mutual support, and those ways in which those two things kind of work together to create the need for this kind of chosen family. And I want to play a quick clip here from a listener and have you reflect on that and what you hear in his story about the dynamics of chosen family. So this is Brandon, who's a medical professional originally from Wilmington.
I was outed by my uncle. I come from a military family. And whenever my uncle told my grandmother, they tried to do their own rituals and things. And when they sent me back home to my mother, she had thought that I needed to visit a therapist and a psychologist. And so she wanted to sign me up for all of these sessions and doctor's appointments. And it took a little time for her to realize that I am who I am. She loved me no matter what. And that if I knew how to be competent enough, to be smart enough, in order to take care of myself and not make mistakes. And my brother was the same way. His overall reasoning for why he was so angry and why he felt the way he did and how he wanted to just, you know, like not be any associated with me at all is because he was scared. It was the lack of knowledge. And then I personally, I have my own dance family that I was able to kind of build. And so I have what I call my dance mom, and my dance mom has actually allowed me to live with her during some of the times that I couldn't go home. And so I've lived with my dance mom. My dance mom knew of my real mother. So she definitely is someone who kind of became like my second mom. And then I have my dance sister, who definitely is also like a real sister for me. So it's been really good to have those two individuals. And then I have like maybe one or two other individuals in my life who are like either an aunt type of figure or a sister type of figure who I can really depend on.
That is Brandon, a medical professional originally from Wilmington. I am talking with Eliar Posada from El Centro Hispano about chosen family. And I want to bring in Chaos to the conversation now. I think you are with us, Chaos, a Durham-based multidisciplinary artist. Welcome.
Yes. Hi.
Hi. So, I mean, we were hearing a little bit from Eliasar about his own personal story. And this concept of chosen family obviously has deep roots, deep historical roots in queer and LGBT communities. And I'd love for you to touch a little bit on that and how that came to play in your own life and your own personal story.
Yeah. I would say it started probably around, like, for me, back in 2016. I was actually going through a very rough patch in my life, dealing with, like, substance abuse, and I also had lost a grandfather and, you know, a lot of other things. And so I was just kind of in a really bad place, and I ended up meeting a friend who was part of the Durham community, and they were just like, yeah, you know, like, anytime you need anything or you're like, you're going through something, like, let me know. You can hang out with me and like my crew and, you know, you'll have like safe space. And ultimately I started hanging out in Durham's queer community and art scene. And I end up, who is now actually my drag sister, Mercury Waters, is the friend who ultimately kind of like introduced me to the community. And from there I started doing dancing and some community work and, you know, some modeling and Durham. And yeah, it was just really beautiful to like have, because my own family at the time really wasn't as supportive of me being queer and trans yet. So yeah, it helped a lot.
Talk about the kind of structure of the family unit within drag and how that operates, because I think it is, you know, this idea of, you know, a sister and a mother and a godmother and a grandmother. Like, I'd love to hear more about, you know, fulfilling those various roles and those various ways that people are connected to one another within the House of Cox specifically that you're a part of.
Oh, yeah. So, like, you know, like any house, like in there's like ballroom houses and like drag houses and whatnot. And the same sort of kind of like hunt, system is just like you have your house mother. Vivica C. Cox is the house mother of the House of Cox. And then there are below that, like the children of the house, like Stormy Day and whatnot. And pretty much like, you know, having a mother in a house is to like have, you know, it's the parent role ultimately, and trying to figure out, okay, like, what does this child of mine need? You know, what are their wants and needs? What are they trying to accomplish? How can we get them to that next step? How can we make sure that they're being successful and feel like they're being supported? Being a part of the house was really awesome. I had a lot of, because there are a lot of people in the house, so I had a lot of siblings, you know, older siblings, you know, who really took time to support me when I felt like I was alone, and felt like, you know, I was like the outsider. And I think it's really important to have, especially for, I feel like, as, you know, with queer people and queer youth, especially, you know, of just having or feeling like there's that support there.
How, I'd love to know from you, Eliasar, kind of hearing that and hearing about your own experience. I mean, comparing the relationship between a biological family and a chosen family and how you negotiate your needs within that context. There's obviously the emotional needs that, you know, many folks are used to getting from friendships, but it goes beyond emotional. It goes to real, you know, structural, like housing, you said. It goes to financial. So how do you establish that within a chosen family network?
And to set the stage, I mean, we have to acknowledge that in the communities of color, family is extremely important. I know in the Latinx community, family is what's there for you no matter what, right? And when some of our LGBT community members are kicked out of that, you know, that network, we build it within ourselves. Being able to communicate and being able to connect with their biological family and, you know, their chosen family, the roles are very different, right? So, for example, when I didn't have any communication with my biological family, my chosen family was there for everything. You know, I mentioned that I ended up staying with one of with Christina for some time. I depended on some of my friends for the emotional support, and thankfully, I had a job, so I could rely on my own economic standing. But then, you know, in my case, with one of the my closest friends, who's part of my family, when he was kicked out of his family unit, you know, he depended on me and stayed with me, not just for housing, but for that economic help. Right, for a number of months, he went from having a home with to not having a home and not having a job and not having any form of income, right? So because of the help that I received in my family, I had to bring him in, right? And I had to be to do that, which it was a unique experience, right? Here I am, a 23-year-old now, responsible for another human, right? Because I chose that, because I get to have that impact that was had with me.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, when we talk about negotiating those who can, you know, communicate with their biological family, you know, for example, in my case, right, I talk to my mother and brother a lot now, and we have a great relationship.
Eliasar, I'm going to pause you for a second and let our engineers reconnect with you, because we're losing your sound a little bit. So while we do that, I want to play a quick clip that I'm going to invite you both to reflect on while we connect. So let's listen to Heather Cook talking about her chosen family and one of the most salient distinctions for her between chosen and biological family.
I think the thing that stands out for me is like the distinction between my biological family and what I call my chosen family here in Durham is that there's just this commitment to holding each other accountable to evolve it. And that's an ingredient in my biological family's relationship, but it's not like at the top of the list. I've got a few text threads, right, of like groups of people where you're group chatting on all the things, but there's one in particular. We are a self-proclaimed coven, and I think the thing that stands out as really special about the connection I have with them and the way that we support each other is that we all come from a lot of different places. We span a pretty decent age range. We span across backgrounds and races. And the one thing that we all have in common is that we're all moms. And so there's just been this powerhouse collective thread of both, you know, commiseration, but also just like an absolute mutual aid network within the seven of us to be able to problem solve both for each other, but for people in our extended communities that we're trying to help out. So everybody has these beautiful angles of being able to like call each other in with like our shared experiences, but then also share out like different ways that we can be engaged and working to support both each other and our community.
That's Heather Cook talking about her story with Chosen Family and Mutual Aid. I'm talking with Chaos, a multidisciplinary artist based in Durham, and we are reconnecting with Eliasar Posada right now. So Chaos, I mean, I think this idea of kind of establishing shared values is something that is really important when you talk about Chosen Family and making sure that, you know, people are on the same page and there's the same level of want to kind of give and give to the structure. Could you talk a bit about negotiating that for yourself within your own Chosen Family?
Thinking.
I guess go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, yeah, there is, like, Durham is, like, Durham, for instance, is a very, within, like, the queer community, there is those same values, especially politically and social conscious-wise and all those things. The goals of just, for me, myself, is just growing, and remembering that we're all on our own journey, you know, and growing as human beings, as growing as a community, you know, and family. For me, especially for me, I oftentimes tend to exclude myself. Well, sometimes depression here. I deal with like, I struggle with like depression. So for me, sometimes I can want to like be a loner.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, one of the things that I feel like my community in Durham really has helped me with is, you know, kind of working through those things and just being like, you know, like we have, you have a team here, you have a community here who's ready, you know, who's willing to make space and whose goals are to make safer space for people and for each other and to try to really be in solidarity within each other's experiences. I've just kind of been, you know, making, you know, having little bumps in the road here and there. But every time for myself, I'm just like, oh, okay, cool. I got this. You know, people believe in me. My community believes in me. You know, my chosen family is always there beside me, you know, to, I need to like give that assistance, and support.
We're talking
Hopefully
about,
that.
Yeah, that's great. We're going to continue the conversation after a short break. I'm here with Eliasar Posada from El Centro Hispano and multidisciplinary artist Chaos, and we will be back on Embodied in just a minute. This is Embodied on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. COVID-19 has forced many of us to think deeply about who's in and out of our bubbles. The recommendations to just stay within your household members might not work for people who share childcare responsibilities or those who live with roommates. The pandemic has not been the only thing forcing us to think about who makes it in our inner circle. There is also politics. Today on Embodied, we're talking about chosen family, those people who are more than friends but not bound by blood or legal documents. And we heard from a listener named Jenny about her experience with chosen family.
Personally, with my family, you know, my parents are on a different page politically. We don't have sort of long, extended conversations about politics, but just not really possible. It's nice to have a chosen family where we can support each other, you know, kind of help each other vet different candidates and look down the ballot and think about other races. So we share a lot of information like that.
I'm here with Chaos, a Durham-based multidisciplinary artist, and Eliar Posada, the Community Engagement and Advocacy Department Director at El Centro Hispano. So Eliar, I'd love to talk a bit more about this idea of mutual aid. It is something that Heather brought up in her comment, and I want to hear about how that works within the immigrant community in particular. We've been talking a bit about chosen family within the context of queer communities, but this is also a concept that is really familiar to folks who are immigrants. I know from my own experience, my parents both immigrated to the U.S., and all of our holidays were spent with chosen family here. I know it's something that you've thought a lot about as an immigrant as well. So take me into that a bit.
Yeah, so it's funny because as folks of the immigrant community, and we have a bunch of uncles and aunts, you know, tías and tíos, that they have no way in any way are related to us, right? But these are folks that we rely on, and that they come in for dinner as all the time. They don't even need a call. Like, we're always together. And they're the folks that we call should there be an emergency, right? They're there checking up on us, right? And one of our family members is sick. They're the ones bringing us food. So as folks migrate into an area where they don't have any, you know, any blood ties, right? So someone may move here from another state or from another country. You immediately look for your people, no, tu gente, my gente, that, you know, who has similar experiences than me, who's from the same area, and you start building that network of, you know, I may not know you, but we have this similar lived experience. So we start becoming a unit, right? Either we find a place to live together, or I move into their place because, you know, they have this network, and we start sharing resources to where to go, where's a good place to get something, or what's an unsafe place for folks to show up in, and what businesses are going to ask you for certain documents and what is not. So there's a lot of that interchanging of information. Many cases, it's not financial, but it's everything that leads to a financial security, right?
Well, so, yeah. And I mean, there's also this kind of transfer and transaction of finances across the borders that brings another element into this for some families who may be physically distanced from those that they left, but are negotiating dynamics between their new chosen family and their biological families back home.
Yeah, no, we have a lot of our community members who are, their families back in their countries back home are depending on them, right? Are depending on those, on that money being sent every month to, you know, pay for housing, pay for education for some of their kids, pay for medicine for some of the family members, and the list goes on, right? So that's definitely a big component of that part of what information is shared when, you know, immigrants move here, right? Where do you go where, if depending on your status, where can you get that, you know, that job that will let you help your family members, or what organizations are going to help you get an ID so that you can be able to send money, or all those different things that folks who have grown up in the U.S. don't really have to think about. Well, you don't think about a driver's license or a bank account, or many of us don't wonder whether I should or shouldn't apply for this job because of status.
Is there much
history of discrimination, or they might hire me, but there might be an issue with pay, right? So that's where a lot of these, you know, circles within the immigrant community come into play, because they'll push you towards good opportunities and keep you from making the same mistakes that other folks in the community have done that have yielded, you know, bad results for our community members.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm curious about how much structural support there is for these chosen families. Chaos, I mean, in terms of queer-owned establishments or the queer community, is there a lot of structural support that kind of takes into account the diversity of family structures in terms of allowing you to take leave time to take care of someone, or really support your chosen family in the way that people are supported structurally to support their biological family?
Okay, so I was going to ask, so you wanted to know about just the establishments around.
I'm curious, just if there are ways in your own life that you have seen structural support for this idea of a chosen family. We know that there's a lot for a nuclear family, ways that you're, you know, able to take sick leave to take care of your kid or your parent, for example. Do you see that same kind of support for chosen families?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think, like, there was a huge, like, a big supportive community. And there's all sorts of, like, events like, for instance, The Conjure, which is, like, this event for, like, Black and brown femmes to, like, come in to, like, dance and whatnot and have a safe place to go. The founder, Gemini, who's an awesome DJ, is one who is really about just, like, supporting especially the Black and brown femmes around them, and just kind of creating different networks with other people to get resources to kind of like bring to The Conjure and then like connect the people who are going to The Conjure in that way. There's also like, you have like the LGBT Center, of course, in Durham that does amazing work and just trying to give support to community members and kind of support the idea of chosen family in a way that we're all connected, you know, where, you know, we keep us safe, you know, we're the community. So, I hope that I'm like trying to make sure I'm getting it.
No, that's perfect. I was curious about your own personal experience. I want to play a quick clip now from Jessica Mason. She's someone that we spoke with who has looked a bit at the national level about the existence of structural support for chosen families. So let's listen to Jessica.
One of the quiet successes in the movement for equality and justice over the past several decades has been that advocates and workers and families fighting for better leave policies have really been able to recognize that an important right for a lot of workers is to care for whoever their family is and not have a really restricted definition of who is supposed to be important to them. And so we have seen some strides in paid sick days laws, as well as those longer term paid family and medical leave laws to include, number one, a broader definition of family. So not just parent, child, spouse, but grandparents and siblings and grandchildren and that broader set of family networks that are so important to many of us. And in addition, a really important move has been to also include in that list some definition of what we might call chosen family. So the text might be something like a person whose close association with the employee is equivalent to a family relationship. And that helps recognize that who the law calls your family isn't always who your family actually is.
Jessica Mason, a senior policy analyst at the National Partnership for Women and Families, talking with Eliasar Posada and Kea. So Eliasar, what do you make of Jessica's point there and this kind of idea that we are really limited in how we think about and how we support the idea of various kinds of families?
No, definitely. It's spot on, right? When I'm thinking of some of the more specific examples, right? So when, for example, if someone's sick, right? And this is something that, you know, I lived through in my experience where my mother had to have her own chosen family because, there was a divorce in my family and, again, conservative family. So that was like a huge no-no for some time. You know, she was a single mother. But based on the laws, when I was sick in school, she couldn't assign someone or at that point, you know, it had to be a family member to come get me. So, and many times she had to stop doing what she was doing, which is trying to make a living for her family and go get me because my tia, who is not really my aunt, but she's, you know, my mom's best friend, and we trust each other with everything, couldn't go get me because she's not a biological, you know, family member. Mm. And then we also see that when we're talking about people in around COVID-19, right, who can and can't go or take care of someone's medical needs, and should someone pass away, who can and can't deal with that person? And many times we have folks who are living here in whatever state they're right here in North Carolina, who have family in Mexico, but then they may pass away, and who takes care of that? And sometimes the consulates take care of it, but it can be very difficult, right? Especially if they have people who are depending on them here who may not be, be married to, or they may not be, that biological family. So there's a lot of restrictions as to, those different scenarios.
And I think, as you bring up the pandemic, this has really illuminated for a lot of people the limitations around, how much we are comfortable communicating these different kinds of intimacy and these different kinds of relationships in our lives. So I'm curious from both of you, do you feel like you have, and I'll start with you, Eliezer, any lessons that you've learned from your experience kind of negotiating intimacy within your chosen family that people could maybe take and apply to what they're going through right now with trying to negotiate these new boundaries around pods and bridging biological and chosen and friend and romance?
Yeah, so I know, and it's great because I know who to go to when I'm having a hard day and I need to feel supported. I know who to go to when I'm having issues with relationships, and those are not the same people, right? I love them both the same, but they're not the same people. When I'm having issues around, making ends meet, I go talk to my brother, or I go talk to who is my biological brother, right? Or having issues with something going around in my family, in my life that's not relationship related, I'll go to him. But when I'm having issues with my relationship or anything around my LGBTQ identity, I don't go to my biological family. I go to my chosen family, right? And when we're talking about this during COVID, and as you may know, the Latinx community is very community centered, right? Mm-hmm. Before pandemic, it wasn't hard to see or rare to see, everyone gathering in the weekend, para una carne asada, right? That's part of our culture. So it was very difficult for a lot of us when this pandemic hit. Now you have to separate, these folks who are part of your family, but some are more closer than others. And then in my work, where part of our job is to support the LGBTQ community, Latinx community, that also brought another challenge of, right, who and how do we handle, these challenges the pandemic brought and provide support for our members. So that meant a lot of phone calls, that meant a lot of text messages, that meant a lot of video calls, because, like I already said, a lot of us don't have, or a lot of folks in our community don't have the privilege that I hold where I can go to both my chosen and my biological family.
I want to play one more quick clip here that I'm going to have you reflect on, Chaos. This is one of our producers, Grant, talking about his experience negotiating boundaries and bubbles in this time.
A bit more than a month ago, I decided to take a leap of faith and try dating in the pandemic. I talked things over with my roommates about going on the first date. I would stay distanced. I would stay masked. I talked on the phone with the person I was going on the date with beforehand. We were going to be outdoors the entire time and would wear masks if we got within 6 feet of one another. And the date was great. At the end of it, we both expressed that we wanted to kiss one another, but that wasn't part of the agreement that I had with my roommates. And so I went back home, and it felt kind of old-fashioned, kind of medieval, of getting a family's permission, but it wasn't my biological family. It was my roommates who were granting me permission to swap spit with this stranger and broaden our bubble. It wasn't an easy decision. We had to talk it through. We kind of got a lot of information from one another about how big our bubble was. We kind of mapped it out, and at the end of the day, decided that we would go for it. I would go for it. But it was a group decision, which was a new experience for me, and I didn't take it lightly. I didn't want this to be a fling, and it added a lot of weight to the romance early on. But one of the difficult decisions that I had to make was to stop seeing my parents who live locally. I had to put certain people in my bubble and others not, just to keep everyone safe, and roommates and romance came before my biological family. And that was a difficult decision, and it's been a difficult balancing act.
That's Grant, one of our producers. I'm talking with Chaos, a Durham-based multidisciplinary artist, and Eliar Posada from El Centro Hispano. Chaos, I only give you about 30 seconds, but if there's anything in Grant's clip illuminates to you about the importance of knowing how to communicate in these intimate situations.
Well, communication in general, so communication is something I'm really trying to work on, especially to my family and chosen family. And just kind of,
You're fine. I give you 30 seconds, so I'm gonna let you keep reflecting on that and say thank you so much to both of you for joining us amidst all the technical challenges. It was really a pleasure to talk with you both. Chaos, a Durham-based multidisciplinary artist, and Eliar Posada from El Centro Hispano. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And if you want to learn more about Embodied, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.